This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
As a person who believes that you have to balance environment with development, if the word balance is a real word and not just a strategy word, I realize that you have to say yes sometimes. So when's the point that you say yes? And that's when I realized, I think in this case, we've hit the point.
When he began research for his new book, The Eskimo and the Oil Man, author Bob Reese thought that he would affirm his belief that Arctic oil drilling needed to stop. But as he delved deeper into the myriad complexities surrounding the exploration for fossil fuels in northern Alaska, he eventually concluded that some drilling was okay. What changed his mind? This week on Sea Change Radio, the second part of our two-part series on the Arctic. This time, we focus on the race to drill for oil in one of the last remaining pristine regions on the planet. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by author and journalist Bob Reese. His new book is The Eskimo and the Oil Man. Bob, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Happy to be here.
You've written several other books, some novels, some nonfiction dealing with global warming and oil issues, but this is unique in that it is a confluence of many of these issues. How did you come across Barrow, Alaska, and give us a little bit of a background on the research into the Eskimo and the oil man?
Well, I live in New York, and I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about northern Alaska. But as a journalist, about 3 years ago, I started hearing pretty fascinating stories coming out of that region. 27 billion barrels of oil offshore is what they were thinking. Trillions of cubic feet of gas. An undersea land rush for territory between the Arctic nations. I found out that the Navy's holding war strategy games, anticipating the possibility of terrorists, ship sinkings, oil spills in the Arctic. I heard that the Russians have started sending bear bombers to buzz us off of Alaska. All this stuff, as a whole ocean that used to be iced over, opens up. And I was trying to figure out a way to write about this big picture. I mean, the whole region is changing at the top of the planet. And then I met two really interesting men. One was a 65-year-old Inupiat Eskimo whale hunter and political leader from Barrow, Alaska. And he had stopped Shell Oil from drilling up there a couple of times. He was the mayor of the North Slope, which is a county the size of Wyoming that fills up northern Alaska. And the other man was Pete Slaby, was the head of Shell Oil for Alaska. And his mission was to drill. And I thought that if it could be possible to get both of these guys to give me access over a year, and if I could follow their story, the story of the Eskimo and the oil man, the story of whether Shell will be drilling for oil up there this coming summer, it would be a way to get at all this stuff, the oils, the hydrocarbons, the undersea land rush, the Navy, the whole place is opening up. And for once, the next place on Earth is part of the United States. It's right on our back doorstep. Are we ready for it?
And the oil man is a little bit less of a complicated figure. His goal, as you said, is to do as his company wants him to do, which is to try to get access to the oil and to extract it. But the Eskimo side of things is a little more, there's a lot more human complexity to it. And you can feel during this book the mayor being torn. Why don't you walk through how his thoughts evolved on oil from when he became mayor to the end of your book?
Well, certainly every community in the United States feels the weight of trying to balance development and protecting the environment. But I think nowhere is this a tougher choice than up in Barrow, Alaska. And the mayor was facing just two choices that kept him up at night and brought him close to tears at times. And here's the deal. Does he support offshore oil or does he fight it? Here's a 65-year-old man who grew up in a place pre-oil where you burned whale blubber for heat. You flew to a high school elsewhere to attend the Bureau of Indian Affairs school, chopped ice for drinking water, homes lacked plumbing, and he really didn't want to go back to that. And the thing is that the North Slope gets almost 100% of its budget from taxing oil infrastructure, oil on land, oil on Prudhoe Bay, which is in the North Slope. But that oil is drying up. The land-based oil is drying up. And the Alaska pipeline, which once provided 20 to 25% of America's oil, is running one-third full. And the tax revenues are dropping. So the mayor needed revenues for rescue squads, for houses, for schools, for pretty basic stuff in a place where a big jar of mayonnaise can cost $36 in a store. You really need money to sustain communities, and especially where in places where the temperature goes down to 70 degrees below zero in the winter. You need that income. Flip side, here you have a 4,000-year-old culture, which values the outdoors as no one else does, and also gets up to 60% of its food from the wild, bowhead whales, walrus, seals. This is a culture that loves the wild, lives for the wild. If you walk around in Barrow, it's every house is sort of like, every yard is like a little museum for people who value the outdoors. Sleds, snowmobiles, fishing nets, walking sticks for walking on the ice. These people love the outdoors, and the last thing you want is a deep water horizon type oil spill erupting under ice and destroying your food supply and your environment. And endangering your livelihood and possibly your life. So what does the mayor do? Just a tough, tough choice. In fact, you might have seen this mayor. He testified before the Deepwater Horizon Commission, and so did the oil man.
So this mayor, Edward Itta, he doesn't want to go back 40 years, he says, at some point in the book, to 40 years ago. And that reminded me of what some cultures may call the oil curse, where they're torn into trying to continue these new revenues that may come with a much steeper cost in the end.
That balance probably is for each culture to decide for itself. You know, Edward Itta is much more than a local leader. He was one of the most powerful rural mayors in the United States in many ways. I've sat in on meetings at the Senate with Edward, where he's talking with senators. I've actually watched him tell a senator what the community needs. You know, we need this, we need this, we need this. I've met with a lobbyist, a law firm, a Georgetown, Washington law firm that works for the North Slope and represents them on the Hill. And the same thing with the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. We're talking about highly sophisticated people who understand the way that the nation works and have the ability to function at the highest levels in Washington, which is one of the reasons why the oil company is so wary around them and wants their support so much.
And I'd imagine that some of the reason for their heightened importance is because of the heightened importance of the resources that they live upon.
Absolutely. And the fact that they have the ability to stop Shell. I mean, Shell is, I think, it's the second biggest oil company on Earth. It's made a huge bet in the Arctic, not just in Alaska, but elsewhere. And there are many people who think that the last great hydrocarbon fields on Earth will be in the Arctic, undersea and on land. And here you have, I mean, Edward had his lawyers challenge Shell in court, stop them dead the first year, the second year, and he is a formidable force, and the people of the North Slope are a political formidable force. Shell knows that. They attribute their early failures to the fact that they didn't deal with the people properly, and they have made adjustments over the last 4 or 5 years to the point that several very prominent Inupiat leaders who opposed them in the beginning dropped out of the lawsuits this year.
And I couldn't help but wonder why it was just Shell that was up in that area. I imagine most of the major oil and gas companies have interests there in the Arctic as a whole. But why is Shell focused on this area, the North Slope? Were they the highest bidder to gain access to this area?
Well, First, you're correct. Shell's the most visible. A ConocoPhillips executive said it this way: Shell leads with their chin. So Shell is the most bullish on the Arctic. They have undersea leases, but so does ConocoPhillips. Statoil, the Norwegian oil company, Eni from Italy. There's a French and Spanish company that also have leases in the Arctic under the sea, and they're watching to see what happens with Shell. So Shell's just first.
Dreamed I was an Eskimo. Frozen wind began to blow. Under my boots and around my toe. Frost that bit the ground below. Was 100 degrees below zero. And my mama cried. And my mama cried.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with author and journalist Bob Reese. His new book is The Eskimo and the Oil Man. You mentioned the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. A lot of the decision-making was occurring right as the Gulf spill was in the headlines, and this was while you're researching the book. How did that oil spill affect the dynamic of the decisions that people like Edward Itta had to make in crafting policy for the North Slope extraction?
Well, yeah, it's such an interesting question. Actually, although I'd been going back and forth to the North Slope for a couple of years for magazines, I would say the actual research on this book started when the Deepwater Horizon was going off. And I sat in on an incredible meeting, which is what gave me the idea for the book. And it was in April of 2010. And Edward, on that day, was, as a whaling captain, he woke up in a tent out on the ice over the Chukchi Sea, because his whaling crew was out there waiting for the bowheads. And on that day, that's where he wanted to be. He wanted to be with his crew. He wanted to be responsible for those guys. He did not want to have to go back to Barrow, but he got up, put a shotgun over his shoulders, because polar bears. He got on his snowmobile, and all alone, he went back through the trails that the Inupiats build by hand on the ice. It takes them weeks. Back to Barrow, because he had a meeting that he was very worried about on that day. And from the flip side, the oil man was on his way in a private jet. Marvin Odom, the president of Shell Oil, had started out from Houston, and then he pulled into the Millionaires Terminal at Anchorage Airport, and he picked up Pete Slaby, and also with Dave Lawrence, who's another Shell executive. Those three executives were flying up to Barrow. Now, you mentioned the Deepwater Horizon, and on that day, I remember Marvin Odom told Edward that he'd been asked to come to Washington. The Deepwater Horizon was in flames. Workers were dead. It was clear that although BP or Halliburton was responsible for it, all the oil companies would feel the wrath of the federal government, and all of them faced the possibility of shutdowns. So Marvin Odom had been asked to come to Washington that day, but he thought it was more important to fly all the way up to the North Slope to meet with Edward, because he wanted to make sure, soothe Edward's feelings and hopefully to explain to him that what had happened in the Gulf couldn't happen, in Shell's opinion, in the Arctic, because the waters were shallower and the conditions were different. And Edward got mad. He got angry, and he made that known. And the Shell executives, backed off and put their hands up and said, no, we'll explain this. We'll take responsibility for this. The tension at the table was profound. And the reaction of these powerful oil men to Edward was equally profound. And actually, it was at that moment when that conversation was going on that I had the idea for the book. I thought, boy, to follow these two groups for the next year, that would really be something if they would give me access. And then I was actually surprised because both parties gave me the access.
You admit near the end of the book that your thinking of it kind of changed and that you didn't go into this thinking that compromise was necessarily a good solution. Compromises have been made, and you definitely were able to see it from both sides of the fence, having access to these people. When you heard these kind of assurances coming from Shell during the midst of this cataclysm in the Gulf, were you suspicious of it, or did you feel like Shell really knew what they were talking about and this couldn't happen up in the North Slope?
Of course I was suspicious. Who wouldn't be suspicious? That's the point. And early on, when I met Pete Slaby privately in his office, and he was deciding whether or not to give me permission, he articulated Shell's position, told me how safe things were, told me what the precautions were, and I said to him, please forgive me, but you have to realize that you may be telling the truth, but the words you're using are the same words that every liar in the world has used too.
Or that if you were talking to somebody, if you were doing this interview 10 years ago about the Gulf exploration with a BP executive, it could have been very similar.
Exactly. So now you're thinking, so what changed your mind? Well, part of what changed my mind was for years in my writing, in talks I might give at schools, I say what I think all of us always say as environmentalists, which is that we need to balance environmental protection with development. And it sounds good, and it's true, and we do. But I also realize that we always say it when we're saying no to something. We never say it when we're grudgingly saying yes to something. So as the research continued, I started to hear things from other people, not from Shell necessarily, that started to make me think more about this. William Riley, the chairman emeritus of the World Wildlife Fund, the co-chair of the Deepwater Horizon Commission, told me that he thought Shell's plan was the gold standard. He thought Shell had been jerked around. He told me that he told President Obama in private that he thought Shell should drill their exploratory wells, not their production wells, their limited plans. And then the head of the Coast Guard in Alaska, I ran into him at a symposium, and I asked him if he was satisfied with Shell's limited exploratory plan that year, and he said yes. He said if they ever want to produce, that's different. They'll need a game changer. But what they want to do now, I'm satisfied. And thirdly, Edward, who at the beginning of the book is, you know, taking the oil guy's heads off in that meeting, well, at the end of the book, he's close to tears when Shell's gets shot down by the EPA. And fourth of all, the Eskimo Whaling Captains Association, it's called the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. These are the most respected guys in their communities. These guys are responsible for the lives of the whale hunters. Everyone looks up to them. They just fought Shell every step of the way. And this year, when Shell made some more concessions, they dropped opposition. And the last time I spoke to one of their spokesmen, I was told, well, don't say anything about Shell. They've really come a long way. So where does this leave me as an environmentalist, but also as an author trying to be fair, and as a person who believes that you have to balance environment with development? If the word balance is a real word and not just a strategy word, I realize that you have to say yes sometimes. So when's the point that you say yes? And that's when I realized, I think in this case, we've hit the point.
So you mentioned in the book how the Alaska pipeline was shut down for testing for a few minutes, and right away the Pentagon was in touch with these people in Alaska saying, you know, this is a national security issue, get it up and running as soon as you can. But that flow has kind of been reduced somewhat to a trickle.
The Alaska pipeline was at one time the source of 20 to 25% of America's energy, and now it's running one-third full. And the story that you're referring to occurred, I'm not going to be right in the year. I believe it was during the 1990s, but there was a disaster drill held because, you know, they get earthquakes in Alaska. And so they had a whole, mock disaster drills, you know, how would we handle an earthquake? And how do we handle the power and the buildings and the pipeline? So the official who in the drill was in charge of the pipeline ordered it, you know, mock game, ordered it shut down so that it could be checked because there was this earthquake, wanted to make sure the pipeline was okay. And because the drill is held between the Alaska state officials and also federal officials all the way up to the White House, within 10 minutes, he heard from the energy secretary saying, well, you have to get that thing running. And that's how important that the pipeline is. But now, because the land-based supply is drying up, that flow has been reduced by 2/3.
If you're traveling in the North Country Fire, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. For she once was a true lover man. If you go when the snowflakes storm, when the rivers freeze and summer ends, please see she has a coat so warm to keep her from the howling winds.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with author and journalist Bob Reese. His new book is The Eskimo and the Oil Man. A lot of these issues have paradoxes within paradoxes. And just from the oil company standpoint, they have this great new opportunity in their minds because of the melting of the polar ice caps. So all of a sudden there's more access, and as oil prices rise, as the price of oil rises, the cost benefit makes sense as well to go into these more extreme conditions to try to extract oil. To connect those dots, saying, oh, well, global warming caused by us burning fossil fuel largely has created this opportunity for us to now get more fossil fuel at a cheaper price. That's one of the paradoxes that you don't see people like Pete Slaby volunteering in his mind. Like it seems like that's something that you just want to shut out if you're working in that world. Did you get that feeling?
Well, I had a very interesting conversation with Michael Chertoff, George Bush's head of Homeland Security, on an icebreaker. I think it was in 2000 and well, when was that? Well, it was the end of the administration, and also with Admiral Thad Allen, who was the head of the Coast Guard at the time, and they were talking about the ice melting. And I asked, so does this mean that the Bush administration now believes in global warming? And they said, we don't want to get into the reasons, but the ice is melting, and if we don't deal with it, we're in trouble. So the book does not get into global warming theory. I have found in the past that as soon as that subject comes up, why is it getting warmer, then nothing else can ever get into the room. Everything gets stuck. You get two sides, nobody changes, and you never get to the meat of the issue. In this book, I wanted to talk about, there's no, as one Alaska official told me, there's no theory that brings the ice back. The ice is disappearing. I believe it's disappearing because of human influences. But if you want to believe that it's disappearing because of sunspots or cyclical temperature variations or natural reasons, fine, it's still disappearing. And what it means is a whole ocean, a whole new ocean that you couldn't sail across before, is suddenly on Earth. It's like we became another planet. And this goes so far beyond oil, because the Russians, for instance, have started escorting commercial ships around the top through their Arctic. And there's a treaty on the table now called the Law of the Sea Treaty, under which Arctic nations can claim up to 200 extra miles of sea bottom, mineral-rich sea bottom, if they can prove it's an extension of their continental shelf. So there's a race for territory going on, which is probably why the Russians have resumed buzzing Alaska airspace with their bombers. Here's another one. I attended a Navy war game last September in Newport, Rhode Island. at the Navy War College. The Navy War College is a great place. And those guys are so proud of what they do. And they like to brag that what they're supposed to do is anticipate logical problems that they will face in the near future. So in World War II, they say, boy, we anticipated everything except kamikaze pilots. So this wasn't the Sierra Club holding war games. You know, it wasn't the Bush administration holding war games. It was non-denominational Navy holding war games. United States Navy, most powerful Navy on Earth. What do we do about the Arctic Ocean? Is there anything to worry about? I was astounded at the scenarios that they gave themselves to deal with. Ready? Here we go. First scenario was, there's a North Korean ship that has nukes in it north of Alaska. What do we do? Next one was, there's a ship in the Northwest Passage, which is the area just north of Canada, which has been iced over for the last 1,000 years and crushed hundreds of explorers over the centuries, but now it's open. There's a ship with terrorists in the Northwest Passage. What do we do? Third scenario, big oil spill. What do we do? And the fourth scenario was, well, there's an emergency. We have to send the fleet from California to Virginia. Usually, we'd use the Panama Canal, but to save time, we want to send it over the top. Can we send it over the top? Now, this was the third war game that the Navy had held in 18 months to anticipate challenges in the Arctic. And it was astounding because these guys took it seriously. They think that the ice is melting so fast that by 2080 or even before, the Arctic Ocean, now imagine, you know, have a vision of the Arctic Ocean in your mind. I've been up there on an icebreaker. I mean, ice, right? Big ice, small ice, pancake ice, fields of ice. The Navy says that by 2050 to 2080, no ice, none. You could go right across the top in the summer. So,
In the summer,
but the summer is still 3 months, and the Russians are thinking about trade routes in North America. It's quite possible that there'll be bulk carriers carrying oil or other mining goods from Canada and Alaska around the top. The Russia and the United States, even as we're talking, they're deciding whether or not to create traffic zones in the Bering Strait because they're anticipating so much traffic. And the Navy guys have started calling the Bering Strait the Bering Gate because they anticipate so much traffic. When I was on the icebreaker, for about 6 weeks or 7 weeks, which was just terrific, and scientists during that cruise were mapping the ocean floor and taking samples in preparation to claiming this territory, undersea territory that I told you about. But on the last day, when we got back to Barrow, and I would copter off and then spend some time in Barrow, there's no harbor in Barrow. You just sort of arrive and you take a helicopter to shore. Well, the Coast Guard crew, this is the Coast Guard, right? Coast Guard is supposed to know when a ship is there. The Coast Guard crew was astounded to see an enormous white cruise ship there, just like a cruise ship you'd see in San Diego or the Caribbean. And it was the Hanseatic or the Bremen. It was a German cruise ship that is now routinely coming through the Northwest Passage. And the people of Barrow didn't know it was coming. The Navy didn't know it was coming. The Coast Guard didn't know it was coming. About 300 tourists just got off the ship, started walking around. That's how fast this place is opening. So the question is the United States dealing with it? Just dealing with it, whatever we decide. And I think, and the book says, that we are last in the race to understand these changes.
Author and journalist Bob Reese, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Freddie Hubbard, Frank Zappa, and Bob Dylan.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Farm Fresh to You Organic Produce Delivery Service, connecting people to farms and leading the progressive change in America's food system. To learn more, go to farmfreshtoyou.com. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.